Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
The dozen records that my father brought back from the war really stay with me. Perhaps it's that thing where you hear something when you're a child and it really resonates very deeply with you and lives with you. In my case, for my whole life, and I still love those records.
This is Essential Tremors.
I'm Lee Gardner.
I'm Matt Byers. The idea behind this show is to have musicians and other creators talk about songs that shaped who they are. We're not looking for favorite songs, necessarily. We're also not looking for songs that they'd choose to take with them if they were stranded on a desert island. What we're looking for are songs that have significance to them. Songs that might have changed the course of their creative lives, or their lives in general.
That's a fine motorbike. A girl could feel special on any such like. Says James to Red Molly, my hat's off to you. It's a Vincent Black Lightning 1952. And I've seen you at the corners and cafes, it seems. Red hair and black leather, my favorite color scheme. And he pulled her on behind and down to Box Hill they did ride.
Richard Thompson is an English singer-songwriter whose work spans over 5 decades. Likely an influence on many of your favorite bands and musicians, his distinct and virtuosic guitar playing is unmistakable. While his technical skills as a player could be lauded on their own, it's the soulfulness of his playing, sometimes punctuated by an aggressive, visceral edge, that sets him apart from so many others attempting to pursue the same path. Thompson could also be credited with bringing Celtic and other traditional folk influences to bear on mainstream rock music through his work with his first band, Fairport Convention, in the 1960s. He's recently released a memoir, Beeswing, Losing My Way and Finding My Voice, 1967 through 1975.
Then I give you my Vincent to ride.
The first song Thompson chose as being formative for him was La Mer by Charles Trenet.
La mer qu'on voit danser le long des golfes clairs a des reflets d'argent, la mer, des reflets changeants sous la pluie. La mer, au ciel d'été, confond ses blancs moutons avec les anges si purs. La mer, bergère d'azur.
This first song that I chose was one of my father's records. My father, in World War II, got stationed in France. So he went over with Montgomery, General Montgomery, on D-Day. And he stayed on, he ended up in Antwerp, in Belgium, for a couple of years after the war, till actually 47, he was in something very shadowy, something called the SIB, which was kind of a branch of the military police. And I think it was a bit like that film, The Third Man. I don't know if you've ever seen that film, where it's basically but you know, post-war Vienna, and it's all drugs and contraband and murders and rounding up Nazis. And my father was involved in that stuff, but he couldn't really talk about it because of the Official Secrets Act. But I digress. So he brought back a bunch of records from the war, mostly French records, Edith Piaf, Jean Sablon, and the record I've chosen is one by Charles Trenet. This is a big hit. It was a big record. And it's called La Mer, the sea. There was a translation of it somewhere beyond the sea by Bobby Darin, where they took the tune and basically did not transliterate the words. They really wrote a whole different song with a whole different sensibility. But I always loved the sound of this record. And as I got to learn a bit of French at school, I tried to translate the lyrics, and I thought, my God, this is so poetic. This is extraordinary. I mean, for instance, there's a line in the song, Berger d'azur infini, the shepherdess of the infinite blue. I mean, this is a pop song. This is like a number one hit in France. And I'm thinking, this is the most extraordinary poetry in this song. The whole thing is just this beautiful poetic images. And I was thinking, well, maybe you couldn't do this in the English language. Perhaps people wouldn't accept something with this level of poetry in it. You know, our lyrics tend to be a bit more straightforward, a bit less imagery, for the most part, in popular music anyway. But as a budding singer-songwriter, you know, I always remembered this song and thought, well, there's other places you can go as a singer-songwriter. You can lean on the world of poetry. You can borrow poetry. You can borrow poetic ideas. You can borrow assonance, consonants, you know, open vowel sounds at the ends of lines, all these kind of ideas, metaphorical ideas, symbolism, and you can jam some of these things into folk song, into popular song sometimes. So this song was always an inspiration to me as a place to go further. That these are places you can do, and you can borrow from other cultures. Although the music that I play is very much based on British folk traditions and rock and roll thrown in there as well. The French influence I think is quite strong in my music as well, although probably it's more subtle. But you know, the dozen records that my father brought back from the war really stay with me. Perhaps it's that thing where you hear something when you're a child and it really resonates very deeply with you and lives with you. In my case, for my whole life, and I still love those records and treasure them. I don't have the originals anymore, but everything's on digital these days, so you can grab La Mer by Charles Trenet, and I recommend it to anyone. It's such a wonderful record.
What age would you have been when you heard these, or was this something from your earliest memories?
Well, it's from the year zero, really. I mean, consciously, maybe when I was 4 or 5 years old, you know, I started to just look forward to the times when my father would put this record on. I couldn't ask to hear it. That was a step too far. I was far too shy as a child to do that. But, you know, I look forward to the times when that record would be put on, and I could kind of dream. And, you know, some records just sound like they were never actually recorded. They just exist. And for me, that's one of those records. You know, I can never imagine actually people in a recording studio, and there's a whole choir on the record that comes in at the last verse, you know, lifts the whole thing to another level. But I just can't imagine it just exists already. You didn't have to record it because it was already there.
I'm curious, are you aware of covers of your songs done in other languages?
Yes, there are some. Always interesting actually to hear cover versions of your own songs. And I think it's very acceptable to take liberties when you're doing a translation and to really just, you know, use the tune as a vehicle for some of your own ideas as well. I mean, you know, My Way, which is a massive hit, of course, but Paul Anka basically took a French tune, again, a French tune, and put different words to it. And that worked pretty well for him.
We had Suzanne Vega on the show. Something you said brings the conversation I had with her to mind, which is She was talking about Bob Dylan and using a lot of imagery in writing, which is not necessarily what a lot of songwriters do today. Especially, you know, I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, the 80s and 90s when, frankly, a lot of songwriters wrote lyrics that weren't really necessarily supposed to mean anything or weren't supposed to be read literally. Mm-hmm. And frankly, that's fine. A lot of those songwriters, it's like, please don't try to write anything that I'm supposed to, you know, take anything literal from. That's good. I'm good. But I'm curious, as someone who has, you know, been writing songs for a really long time and you know, many great songs, and but they're songs meant to be legible, you know, these words are supposed to be there for you to understand them. Do you appreciate, or do you get something out of songs that are sort of just that impressionistic, there just to be sounds type of songwriting?
Well, as you say, I mean, it depends. You know, I mean, for dance music, perhaps you don't expect too much more than something just, you know, describing movement or just describing, you know, sex or something. You know, just very basic stuff. But then, you know, that there are some great, like, Motown lyrics, which is also supposed to be dance music, you know, Dancing in the Street by Martha and the Vandellas, you know, has a good lyric. As do a lot of Motown songs, that the lyrics are in some cases very thoughtful, very very poetical, very political sometimes. So you can shove all those dimensions into, you know, a basic dance song, a dance rhythm, but you don't have to. I mean, you know, it's acceptable to have something that really is just a pulse, and you put words to it that just sound good. You know, that they don't have to mean too much. That's okay, you know, that really is okay.
Pour la vie.
The second song Thompson chose is essential to his...
Support for WYPR comes from the Park School of Baltimore's Saturday morning Rise and Shine activity sessions for children 3 to 5 years of age. Nature expedition through the Park School woods is April 20th. parkschool.net/shine.
Formation as an artist was the traditional British folk tune, The Bonnie Bunch of Roses, played by Joe Haney.
Find their margin of the ocean, one pleasant gleaming in the month of June. One all the feathered songsters, their liquid notes to sweet. As there I met a female, and all her features were signs of woe. Conversing with a young Bonaparte concerning the bunny bunch of roses.
Okay, the second piece is a traditional song. It's still is sung in England. And certainly Ireland, Scotland, maybe a bit as well. It's a song called The Bonnie Bunch of Roses. And it goes back to the Napoleonic era. And there are many songs, traditional songs in Britain, about Napoleon. Some for Napoleon and some against Napoleon. Most of the ones for Napoleon come from Ireland and Scotland, where they thought it might be better to have Britain overthrown by the French so that they could make a new deal or get independence from England. And then there's the more English ones that they're actually anti-Napoleon. there are several songs that talk to Napoleon's son, which are interesting, you know, saying, you know, you saw what happened to your father, don't go down the same road. And The Bonnie Bunch of Roses is really a song that's about how wonderful the British Isles are and how that union should not be broken. And it's what they call a big song. You know, there are traditional songs that everybody sings. I was having a drink, you know, late at night with Luke Kelly of the Dubliners one night, and people are sitting around singing songs. And I said, Luke, you know, sing the Body Bunch of Roses. And he said, can't do it. It's too big for me. I can't sing that song. You know, incredible respect for the tradition and for the weight of the song. And that's a song that uses, you know, some wonderful imagery. I mean, the Bonnie Bunch of Roses to represent, you know, the four countries, you know, of England, Ireland, Scotland, Wales. You know, it's a wonderful image of itself. When I think of... you know, how do you learn songwriting? How do you get ideas? How do you study the art of songwriting? I think, well, you know, the traditional music of the British Isles is a great place to start, because it's all there. You know, it's very spare. Every verse counts. Verses that are superfluous to the narrative tend to get dropped over the course of, in some cases, hundreds of years. You know, the language can be very beautiful, incredibly poetic sometimes, extraordinary images. Sometimes the songs are very compressed as well. I mean, there's no wastage. You know, like a Hank Williams song, you know, there's no lines that are superfluous to the emotion. And I think with the traditional song, there's no lines that are superfluous to the storytelling. It's just a wonderful narrative. In many ways, the Bonnie Bunch of Roses is just one song that I can pick out from a vast tradition. Many, many songs share the qualities of the Bonnie Bunch of Roses. And I chose a version. I don't even know if you can find it. The version by Joe Heaney, who was a wonderful, wonderful singer. And he could... sing a song that big. He had the right gravitas to deal with a song of that size. So that's the Bonnie Bunch of Roses.
Well, and this is a song that that Fairport Convention also recorded. Was there any trepidation about stepping into that, a song of that magnitude?
Well, I think there was. It's a song that we recorded. It ended up on a kind of, you know, like a best of album. I don't think we actually put it on the record it was intended for. And bizarrely, we were on an American tour, and we said, well, we'd love to record at Gold Star Studios in Los Angeles. That's where Phil Spector used to record. You know, wow, that must sound great. Let's go in there and cut some tracks. So we recorded, I think, three tracks. We're using... the engineer, the old Spector engineer, Doc, who is an absolute amazing character. And stuff did sound amazing in that studio. Things kind of jumped off the tape. You know, things sounded very loud in there. It's amazing. And, you know, Dave Swarbrick, our fiddle player, sang it. And he didn't have any qualms about singing a song like that, a song of that size. I always had my doubts. But Swoop seemed happy to sing it, and I'm not sure our version really has the right weight to it, but we tried.
Well, I mean, it's pretty dramatic, so, I mean, I think at least you did your best. So.
We did our best, for sure, yes.
Yeah, yeah. I'm really struck by that idea that you just discussed, the idea that if something doesn't work, it doesn't stick around, and the idea of these songs being sort of winnowed and pruned over, you know, in some cases, hundreds of years because of, you know, oral tradition and people singing them and altering them and, you know, tweaking them and surviving. And, you know, so at this point, they're pretty distilled and, you know, the people remember them because they're memorable. And as memorable as they're going to get, I guess, right?
Yeah, you know, they are lean. I mean, the other thing that does happen is people half remember them, you know, at various points, and then the song kind of splits into different variations. And some of the older songs, I mean, some songs going back to the sort of 1600s maybe, you might find 20, 30 variations, and people love to put a local name in there, you know, like a local place name. So they hear the song, but they think, you know, I'm going to make this more about where we come from. So there'll be a Scottish version, there'll be a Welsh version, you know, there'll be a West Country version. and sometimes things just get misheard. You know, Matty Groves, quite a famous ballad. You know, is also known as Little Musgrave. You know, Matty Graves. You know, there's all these kind of variations from people half hearing the name. So you know, the plot tends to be the thing that is consistent. But you know, the details and the place names can change. But you know, these songs are very lean. If you think how many people a song might pass through over 100 years or 200 years, that's a lot of people. And things inevitably are going to change, but usually they change for the better and the bad stuff disappears.
Well, and the people and the places are less important than the reason that people sing the song, right? The plot and, you know, the characters and the motivations and the reasons that people do the things that they do in the song. But one of the things that really struck me in your book was this sort of theme, and I mean, it's a pretty obvious theme of you sort of doggedly sticking to Britishness, Englishness, not wanting to play, you know, American cover songs, or not wanting to do more of those than sticking to a more English sound, you know, wanting to do English and Irish and Scottish folk music and not, you know, go in another direction, you know, looking for that, the source, those roots rather than, you know, playing around with other roots. And, you know, you do a good job of explaining that, but I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
At a certain point, Fairport felt that we were being rather secondhand in our musical style, that we were taking American forms and we weren't contributing very much of ourselves in that process. And we didn't want to be like, you know, a British blues band, a British R&B band. We wanted to be something a bit more original, something a bit different. We wanted to stand out as a band. And so we decided it would be a good idea to base our roots much more on the British tradition, on English, Irish, Scottish traditional music, and blend that with rock and roll, and blend that with electric music, amplified music, electric guitars and drums, all that stuff. So that was the idea. And at the same time, we thought, well, this is something that's going to resonate more with us. If we can actually do this properly, then this is our homegrown music. This is our tradition. This is something that we can be proud of. This is something that perhaps will touch the audience as well, but the audience will recognize it and say, aha, you know, this is a reawakening of our culture. And we hope that the audience would embrace it. And to some extent they did, but it never became, you know, that popular. It was never like chart music. It was always a bit of a cult, a bit of a sort of a side avenue of popular music. So that was really our ambition. It was really just, you know, A, to be original, and B, to be playing something that was that would reverberate more with us and with the audience.
You know, I'm originally from East Tennessee, and yeah, I'm from near the town of Knoxville, and of course, there's a Knoxville Girl is a traditional song from the Appalachia. Which is, of course, and I have forgotten the etymology of all this, is an adaptation of a traditional ballad that comes from England or Scotland, I forget where. Mm-hmm. So in a real way, you know, a lot of American roots music comes from, you know, English roots music and Scottish roots music. So it's all sort of bound up together. So, you know, yeah. In many ways, American roots are our music, are your roots music. So thanks, I guess, I would have to say.
Yeah, it's true, yes. It's just, it's a more circuitous route, really, in a sense. So much music survived intact in the Appalachian Mountains and the Smoky Mountains from European culture, especially British culture. And you know, that became country music, and so that was a huge arm of American popular music. Yes, the roots are common. I think we just wanted to short circuit that process a bit more and just grab it straight from, you know, the British tradition. And at that time, I mean, you know, British traditional music wasn't sung that much. Some people thought it was dying out. there was a lot of collecting going on in the sort of 50s and 60s, trying to find what they thought were the last of the traditional singers, so that music could be revived. So you had a big revival in the 50s, another one in the 60s, and you could say Fairport was another revival. You know, taking it electric was bringing that music back to a wider audience in the late 60s.
Is that music still important to you? Maybe that's an obvious question, but I'm curious.
No, it really is, and it's still a big root of what I do, you know, melodically and lyrically. So, yes, it's very important.
Will enshrine the bonny bunch of roses.
The final song Thompson chose as being crucial to him was With Drooping Wings by the English composer Henry Purcell from his opera Dido and Aeneas.
Well, the next piece of music is a piece of classical music. It's from Henry Purcell, who some consider the greatest English composer. He's certainly up there with, you know, Benjamin Britten, maybe Elgar Vaughan Williams, but perhaps he's greater than all of them. And he was a 17th century British composer, and he wrote this opera called Dido and Aeneas, and he wrote it for a girls' school. I'm not quite sure the nature of this girls' school. It certainly wasn't like the school my sister went to, but it must have been pretty amazing girls' school. And it's a short opera. It's a one-act opera, and he must have been on a very hot streak that particular week or month or however long it took him to write it. It's a sublime opera, sublime piece of music. There are famous passages from this opera. There's the famous Dido's Lament, When I'm Laid in Earth, which is fairly well known, which is a staggeringly good piece of music. And after Dido's death, I think the last piece in the opera is this piece called With Drooping Wings, which is sung by Dido's attendants. And for me, this is the closest music to heaven that I know of. It just sounds angelic. It sounds, I don't know if you've ever had those dreams where you're hearing some celestial choir in your dreams. This incredible music of the spheres, this staggering harmony going on. Then you wake up and you sort of forget about it. But for me, this is like waking celestial music. It's kind of sublime. It's fugal. It kind of fugues. The voices come and go in different places and start and stop at different times, but it has this really transcendent effect. It's a mournful piece of music, but it's a very transcendent piece of music. And you know, I think I've loved classical music for a long time, since when I was a kid. And it's another thread for me of musical experience. And for me, rather like jazz, I think it's a place where I go to learn about harmony, to learn about music. Even if I don't play classical music, I can grab ideas from it. I can take a bit of this and a bit of that and put it into what I do and hopefully enrich what I do. But Henry Purcell, I just kills me. I think he had a fairly short life, but I think he was as good as anybody. And if I think sometimes you feel that you have a composer or a, you know, maybe a singer who speaks for you, who sings the music, you know, exactly the way you would want to hear it. And for me, Purcell writes that way. He writes things that I think, wow, this is just absolutely tailor-made for me as a listener, that this is the experience, the musical experience that I want, and this man is delivering it. So that's Henry Purcell, and the piece is With Drooping Wings, strongly recommended.
There's a funny bit in your book where you, in one of your early jobs, and I can't at this point remember what you were doing, but you talked about playing Purcell and other English composers, and your coworkers making fun of it a little bit. They liked Wagner or something like that.
Well, I worked for two German designers. I was kind of apprentice as an art designer, and we were making a lot of stained glass windows at the time. So I'd be left in the workshop making the windows, and there'd be a feed in the workshop from the record player, and Hans and Eberhard, who were my employers, you know, loved German music all the way from top to bottom. You know, so they played a lot of Wagner, lots of Beethoven, lots of Mozart, occasionally something more modern like Hans Werner Henze, which I really enjoyed. And every week there'd be a run to the record library, you know, and they'd say, well, anything that you want to hear? And I said, yeah, I'd love to hear some Vaughan Williams or some Elgar. And they say, oh, that English sentimental shit. So they saw English music as overly sentimental, and in a way it is. I think it actually is overly sentimental, but it doesn't mean I don't like it. It doesn't mean it isn't actually great music in other ways. I grew up listening to Vaughan Williams and Elgar particularly, and a little later in life I got into Benjamin Britten, who I also absolutely love. So for me, these are like home composers, you know. I love Beethoven. You know, I love Russian music as well. I love Shostakovich, Stravinsky. But if I want to come, you know, metaphorically home musically, then I might put on some Elgar or some Vaughan Williams.
Well, and I do think there's something to that that idea that I think that you were expressing a minute ago, of that sometimes you just find something that speaks to you, you know, for whatever reason, and maybe it's because it relates to your, you know, it's a piece of your own country or your own culture, or it just happens to be the right set of harmonies and melodies, and it gets you, and it does. There's no arguing with that. So,
Yeah, I think so. I mean, there's something to be said for that kind of familiarity. You know, there's a kind of familiarity of the music, certainly, and someone like Vaughan Williams was using traditional melodies. He was a great collector. He'd go out and collect folk songs, and then he would put them into his compositions. He also discovered that things like Greensleeves, that's something we take for granted, you know, alas, my love, you do me wrong, da 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 da. And we wouldn't know that without Vaughan Williams. Vaughan Williams found that, and his orchestration of it is the one that we think of. You know, he harmonized it. And set it for a classical orchestra, and I think our familiarity with that song is thanks to Vaughan Williams. And I think also someone said that all British art, you know, which includes music, keeps referring back to the landscape. It's like there's always this kind of pastoral thing that kicks in. You know, you certainly hear it in Vaughan Williams. You hear it in Elgar as well. that you're always referring back to the landscape, so the landscape becomes a common theme. You know, you go right back to Chaucer, and then you go to Shelley, but then you go to Purcell, and you go to Constable or Turner. You know, and, you know, it's the same thing about the landscape. The landscape's this permanent thing that doesn't change that much, and it's a reference point. It's a common reference point all through the centuries.
Where does it show up in your work, do you think?
Ha ha ha. No idea. I don't have perspective on that. Sorry.
This has been Essential Tremors. Essential Tremors is produced by me, Matt Byers, and Lee Gardner. Essential Tremors is distributed by WYPR, Baltimore. To get in touch, get more information, or buy Essential Tremors merchandise, go to EssentialPodcast.com. Thanks for listening.